trip, so.
Anybody have papers, Stu?
Oh, you see that?
Yeah, what about Towson? When do you have papers due? Anybody have a paper due in the next couple of weeks?
I was just working on mine. I'm a graduate student now. I have a paper due tomorrow.
Uh-huh. So how much of it have you done?
A little bit of it.
That's going to be an all-nighter. No, actually, I'm in reasonably good shape.
Uh-huh.
I'm in reasonably good shape.
Uh-huh. That's good. It's a pleasure this evening to welcome Mike McCurry, who's press secretary to President Clinton. And as he was indicating, today he combines a couple of different roles. He works at Public Strategies Washington, and he works with corporate clients and with a lot of nonprofits as well. And he is a student. He is working on a master's degree in divinity, and it's an academic degree. And he is going to, with a goal.
So there's no fear that I'm going to become a preacher. God still has standards, it turns out.
So he is going to teach religion and politics.
Yeah.
Let's start there. When did you get the interest of doing this combination?
Around about the time Monica Lewinsky.
I was going to say, did the Clinton experience drive you to it?
I not long after I left the White House, I was active all during the time I worked in the White House in my local Methodist congregation. And I was approached not long after I left the White House by the folks at Wesley Theological Seminary, which is a Methodist-affiliated institution up next to American University, for those of you that know Washington well, and asked to go on their Board of Governors. So I've been a member of their Board of Governors since 1999. But not long ago, the guy who's the dean of the faculty said, look, I'm going to teach my survey course in the Old Testament one last time, and I'd really like for you to be a student in the class. And I said, well, that's an interesting idea. And I said, why would I do that unless I was working on a degree? He said, fine, work on a degree, apply, and we'll consider admitting you. So I did that, and I've actually really enjoyed being back in the classroom with a lot of very idealistic young people who are going to become ministers. Most of them are bound to become Protestant ministers at some point, but then there are some derelicts and sinners like me in the class who are just there for continuing education or for other things. And as Martha indicated, I do have a very strong interest in the interrelationship of values and moral belief systems and religion and the impact that has on public policy and policymaking. It's an area in theology, it's called public theology, and it's a program, there's going to be a program just right down Massachusetts Avenue here at the Mount Vernon United Methodist Church, a collaboration between that church and the Methodist denomination, and then the Wesley Seminary, where I am a student and a member of the board. And we're going to really develop a program there in religion and politics. It should be interesting. So if any of you are double majors in political science or religion or anything like that, this would be an ideal program if you're interested in that sort of thing.
Where do you see religion coming into politics in Washington, and what kind of force has it been?
Well, you see it in a lot of different ways. It has been since the, if you go back to the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement, that is in some ways the last point at which the progressive left or the left of center really drew upon moral arguments and scripture in pursuit of real public policy changes. Of course, if you think of Dr. King's letter from Birmingham Jail, which probably many of you have read, that is primarily a theological treatise addressed to white ministers about why the need for, you know, a more aggressive approach on pressing the case for civil rights is necessary from a scriptural basis. I think at the end of the 1960s, the left largely abandoned the arguments built around values and faith in arguing for certain types of change and became very secular. And of course, in that same period, the Christian right became to dominate a lot of politics, and we began to think of, you know, the religious debate being really focused much more on the conservative side of the agenda. But within the last two election cycles, I think progressives and liberals have rediscovered an authentic voice that's based on Scripture, and the Christian faith tradition is based around Scripture texts like Matthew 25 that really call on people of faith to be concerned about the least, the last, the lost, the people who are dispossessed, the prisoners, the hungry, the homeless. And so you see it emerging, to answer your question, in things like the debate over the budget. The budget is primarily a moral document because it reflects priorities and what we value as a society and what is the common good. I think you see it in the debate now over issues of war and peace. You certainly see it reflected in some of the comments around torture and what is, you know, the moral argument against treating fellow human beings in that way. I think you see it around debates about environmental protection and global climate change. In the, you know, in the faith tradition of the Abrahamic religions, it's about how do you protect God's creation. So I think, you know, you're seeing it now play out in a lot of different ways, and I think it's a very healthy thing. I think it would be wrong to sort of impose religious perspective on all matter of conversation about public policy, and I think there are plenty of people in this country who are secular or non-believers, and I think if you look at Obama, remember his inauguration address, he made a careful effort to acknowledge that freedom of religion includes the freedom to unbelieve, if you so choose. So I think we've got some interesting things going on, interesting new contexts of debates, and it's a, particularly among young people, I see this now, I guess, because I'm more on campus, a real hunger for more conversation about how religion and faith informs the public marketplace. And I think you see it in the current president, too. I think Barack Obama is someone who is a very deeply spiritual person, and that's a very important part of his own way in which he argues the case for his program.
What do you see as the difference between young people when you started in politics and young people today?
Well, I mean, they're twofold. I think there's, when I started, but I have to say, a long time ago now, because that's back in the 1970s, ancient civilizations existed at that time. Thinking of writing papers, we used a thing called a typewriter. Have you ever heard of such devices? They're at the located at Smithsonian, if you ever want to go down there someday. But that is a very real difference, the degree to which the technologies of communication are just naturally a part of the life of most of the people in this room, you know, certainly people who are under age, you know, 40. For people over age 50, it is an acquired skill. And some of us are still pretty clunky at it, but it has really redefined the way in which we access information, process information. It's redefined political communication and how we persuade people. And I think it has a substantial impact on the way younger people think about politics, converse, debate, how you, you know, gain information about issues of the day. It's really profoundly different now, and we probably will talk a lot in the session tonight about the impact of the 24/7 news cycle and things like that. But so part of the answer is it's mechanical. The technology has become so embedded in the way we live our lives, and I think younger generations have a different way in which they've processed that technological change. And then the larger one is the degree to which there's a sense of communal good or common good, and an idea that we're not all out racing off to become investment bankers at Wall Street anymore, since it ends up that's not such a hot career these days. I think there is more interest in how we collectively take action to improve the lives of entire communities. And I think that's a more idealistic tendency among younger people in particular. But I see it, you know, the degree in which people are volunteering, participating, believing that they can really be a part of the profound political change that's occurring in this country. There's just a high degree of idealism that I don't think I've really seen since way back in the 1960s.
Uh-huh. And also a tolerance among young people that that maybe older people do not have. For example, even within the conservative movement, while the older parts of the conservative movement are very much against gay rights, for example, that's not the case. And younger conservatives just don't see that as an issue that they're particularly interested in. They're not going to waste their time on it.
I really believe that's true. I think if you look at the exit poll data from the last election, there is a marked shift of opinion below age 50 and above age 50. And of course, if you're a partisan Democrat the way I am, it's actually largely favorable to our side of the argument, mm-hmm. because under age 50, it's disproportionately Democratic leaning in terms of the partisan composition, disproportionately left of center in terms of the ideological shift, and then in terms of who the voter supported. Under age 50, I think it was like 65% on average across the country for Obama. And above age 50, the only category of voter that McCain actually won was over age 65. So there's a real generational shift that's occurring. And I agree with you, Martha, that it's partly a tolerance, it's idealism, but it's also a real pragmatism. There's a stronger desire among the cohort that many of the students are a part of for real solutions that work, things that are demonstrated to be successful in solving problems, not just, you know, where they come from on the ideological spectrum. It's more about, you know, what works to actually solve problems and tackle things that need to be fixed.
How do you see the changes since you first got into White House politics? And that includes the candidates you work for who are aiming for the White House. And today, in terms of how they gather, process information, and then talk to the people?
Well, in the 1970s, when I first came to Washington, when I got out of college in 1976 and went to work in the Senate as a Senate press secretary, the landscape then was defined by what we now call the traditional or mainstream media. It was very concentrated. The model for communication was mass media, mass communication. So what appeared on the network news was important. What appeared on the major wire services carried out to a lot of news organizations in the country, that was important. And you oriented yourself to sort of controlling those messages that went out to that large mass communicated broadcast media. I think the model now is entirely different. The politics of the age of Clinton, even, is very different from the politics of the age of Obama. I think arguably with Karl Rove's innovation in the campaigns of 2000 and 2004, which was to focus political communication on grassroots networks, which they did very successfully. We can go off on a digression on that if people are interested. I think that model of orienting towards the grassroots and narrowcasting message delivery, targeting the delivery of message on individual categories of voters or constituents, and having separate simultaneous conversations with the voters rather than one large national conversation dominated by the national media, those are all very different models for how you reach the voter, how you persuade. And I think they're having profound impacts on the science of political communication. So that's very different. And the skill sets that go into that, I mean, you get arguably Bush and Clinton were the last of the baby boom presidents, because I think we're moving into a new model for what we expect of national leadership. And it's, you know, Barack Obama sort of typifies that type of leadership. It hits home for me a lot when I think, wow, this is the first president who's younger than I am, because I've never experienced that before. But it's also a very different kind of president with a different way of talking and communicating, a different kind of vocabulary, a different vernacular. He just sounds different than politicians of the Bush-Clinton era, which are kind of were the dominant figures in the time I was coming up through politics. So I think we've seen, I mean, there's a lot of very, very important changes in the way in which we elect national leadership and who we think of in categories of national leadership. And I think these changes are permanent. I think we're going to see more of that as we go forward.
If you look at Bush and his emphasis, and I think a session that you and Dan Bartlett did here in 2005, Dan was talking about their efforts to deal with the audiences of Field and Stream and, did Runner's World, Bicycling Magazine, Golf, and what he called the hook and bullet crowd. And they were looking for people that they could appeal to not on the basis of policy, but on the basis of getting to know the president. Well, you could say, what did that get them? I mean, it did get them. He was reelected, but he left office. He finally rose up, I guess, to 30% in favorability.
Yeah, well, it's not, I mean, it's proof, and this is a very important point. It's not all about public relations. At the end of the day, it's also about policy and the effect of the policy and whether or not you're successful in accomplishing things that the voters expect of you, and the Bush team was not.
Right.
There were fundamental flaws in the way in which they approached governing the country that were not just about how they communicated or what kind of press releases they put out or how sophisticated they were in targeting messages to individual people. But I don't miss the point here. They did start to develop a new methodology for communicating that really did leverage this more targeted person-to-person approach for communicating, and I think that's here to stay. That's clearly how Obama communicated during the course of the 2008 campaign. I think in some ways, I spent the last 8 weeks of the 2004 campaign flying around with John Kerry, and I often say we ran a great campaign. In fact, we even thought we had won on Election Day, but the problem was we were running the last campaign of the 20th century, and Rove and the Bush team had started to invent these new tactics that I think more typify how we're communicating and persuading in the 21st century. But, you know, at the end of the day, you have to, your policies have to measure up and they have to, you know, achieve the goals, the large goals and vision that you set out for the country. And Bush just didn't get that job done.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, though, you know, it looks as if Obama has a dual strategy. On the one hand, he's dealing with very specific audiences. If you look at his interviews, for example, he did many more interviews than Clinton did in his first 100 days. Clinton had 8 interviews in his first 100 days, and Obama has had, 26. And in Obama's case, he has dealt with very specific constituencies, like going to Al Arabiya to send a message that dealt with our wanting a different sort of relationship with the Muslim world, black enterprise to talk to a black constituency, Eddie Sotelo of Univision, Jorge Ramos of Univision. So there are a lot of very...
And he's also used interactively the Internet through the bringing the traditional Saturday, quote-unquote, radio address into the Internet age. He's had online press conferences. I mean, they at least experimented with them. I guess you could argue how effective those were. But I think he is experimenting with using the medium of the Internet in a new interactive way, and I think that's very important in addition to the types of interviews he's done.
And then he is the first president to have more than one nighttime press conference in his first East Room in his first 100 days. Nixon had one, and otherwise no president before Obama had a nighttime newser, and now he's on his third. So in a way, what it seems like is on the one hand, he's trying to create and get to a national audience, which I think recent presidents have not had quite the opportunity that he has because of the economic and financial situation. So he's seizing that opportunity, get to a national audience, but at the same time, deal with some specific constituencies, like in his second news conference in the East Room at night. He called on Stars and Stripes so he could talk about military issues, and then called on a woman from Univision because earlier that day he had done a Mexican border initiative, and so he could figure that that question was going to come up, as well as calling on all of the television networks. So that's probably something he can't keep rolling, because Fox is not taking it tomorrow.
I think that was a his ability to get that national audience is a combination of extraordinary interest in him,
yeah,
because of
right.
the historic nature of his presidency, the multiple crises that he's had to face in the first 100 days of his presidency with everything happening both overseas and in the economy. And then I do think that there is a, I'm not suggesting that there is not a national press corps or a White House press corps that follows the president and creates a narrative that is a part of what, you know, a day in the life of the president is about. The best evidence of that is the Obama puppy. You know, like the whole country knew about that. There was a national conversation around that interesting personal glimpse in what his life as president was like with his family. So there is interest in that, and there is a national narrative that develops and that kind of goes into the image or the brand that we associate with the figure of the president. But the important point, and you're hitting on it, is that underneath that there was this very targeted, direct way of going and talking to specific audiences about things that, you know, the White House knew that that audience would be interested in hearing about. And I think that's a hallmark of what the new model of communication is about.
What makes that new model possible? What are the technical elements of it?
Well, one is just the collapse of what we call the mainstream media. There's just the fragmentation of the national audience, which no longer now rivets around three network news broadcasts that come on at exactly this hour every night, because appointment television and a national audience gravitating to a national broadcast news doesn't yield the same percentage of an audience that it used to. I think even as late as when I was working for Bill Clinton in the 1990s, you could still get 75-80% of the country reporting that it was getting some substantial portion of news from those network news broadcasts every night. That percentage is down to something like, 30-35%.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we see the audience filtering out to, you know, cable channels or internet-based channels or blogs or whatever people are going to as a source of information. And I think, by the way, increasingly not electronic delivered journalism either. They're going to people they trust in the community. They're going to people who are, you know, at the PTA meeting or at church or at the supermarket who look like they're, you know, knowledgeable and there's someone that you can trust because they seem to know what's going on. I think those are reliable communicators for many people, and that's where a lot of information comes from. That's one of the reasons why I think the politicians are shifting their message to delivery to what they call the influentials in a community. There's much more attention being paid to that kind of communication as well. So there's part of the ability to do this is just the fragmentation of the audience. The second thing is the enormous capacity of the internet and data management to target individual consumers of news. We give up an awful lot of our personal identity when we're online. We indicate to large content providers, content aggregators, who we are, what we're interested in, what we're likely to click on or look at, and, you know, very large, massive businesses like Google are built around the information we voluntarily cough up about ourselves as we use this tool, the internet, to do what we want to do. And so that makes more possible the high degree of targeting that you see. And then I think the other thing is that just people are interested in niche areas. You mentioned Dan Bartlett from the Bush White House communications operation indicating that they would target runners or hunters or people who had their own, you know, they did a long interview with Ammo Magazine with President Bush. And I, you know, presumably the Obama people are doing some variant of that as they reach out and communicate with niche audiences as well, because people, you know, like specialty publications that respond to the personal interests that they have in life, and that makes targeting like that more possible as well.
What about targeting individual voters? Because I know from students who have had internships during election years in the last couple of cycles in Maryland, that they were armed with statistics that would tell them in individual households who to go to, not only how they were registered, but whether they had voted and other factors about them as well.
Well, that's old-fashioned targeted voter mobilization. The equivalent of that in the early 20th century were the ward machines that actually kept 3x5 cards on people, and they knew every household and what every household's need would be. And that, you know, there's a political machinery that does that. But the other important part of this is the way in which you interact with the information if you're online and get drawn into the conversation. It's not one way. I think it's very, very critical. It's not just someone from on high delivering information to the individual household. It's asking the individual household to respond, to interact, to voice an opinion, even sometimes to participate in governance. Give us your 10 best ideas, or vote for this commercial over that commercial. The different ways in which I think the Obama campaign successfully engaged a lot of their supporters online was really about this new model. Now, they were trying to search for ways to convert that into governance, and it's not clear that the tactics of voter mobilization easily convert over to the more difficult task of helping run the country. But they're doing some experiments with that, and they're bringing people online and asking people to be a part of a conversation. So we'll have to kind of watch and see how that develops and whether they're successful. I think over the course of the remainder of this year, you know, about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, this is going to start getting a lot more difficult for the new administration, because they are going to move into the period where real compromises and trade-offs and saying no to certain constituencies and saying yes to certain parts of the agenda that the opposition is advancing. We're going to start blending different ideas in the name of getting some legislation together that will try to make it through Congress. And how that plays out and how the Obama administration marshals support for that agenda is the story that I think happens now at the end of 100 days as we look ahead to now to the end of the year. And, you know, mm-hmm. That's when we'll get a real report card, not the faux report card delivered by the press tomorrow at the end of 100 days, but we're going to get some, you know, real results on whether or not we've started to bring the change that we can believe in to the way business is done in Washington.
When you look at the internet, all the information that we have, we certainly can't complain that there's not enough information, but we could complain, as we've talked about before, and you've observed that it's not a question so much of not having enough information. It is, how do you bring understanding? How do you manage that information and pull it together in ways that even people within an administration can understand, as well as the public at large? How do you do that?
Well, no one's got a good answer to that yet, because otherwise we wouldn't see so many journalistic enterprises collapsing and so many reporters out on the street homeless.
Yeah.
With no jobs, because that is the task. I mean, that's what we have got to invent, new economic models or business models that work to provide exactly that kind of information, if we're going to keep a journalistic enterprise or a fourth estate at the heart of how we kind of keep accountable the people who have political power. And that's a really tough problem, because nobody's figured it out yet. But my argument is that, yes, there is. I mean, there's so much information out there, it's just incoherent. And so the news sites that are aggregating content that also have simultaneously a reputation for complete accuracy and reliability, I think those are the ones that actually will bring something of real value to a consumer. They're just going to then figure out how much can they charge that consumer for the value of that content. And that's where we're still experimenting, but I think we'll see a lot more experiments in the years ahead about how do you bring together content that's really useful and important to people that people want, and then figure out how people will pay for it so there's a real revenue that attaches to it. Because it's not, there's part of the internet is just it's this wonderful cloud out there in which everything is beautiful and free and accessible, but you know, that's not the way the real world works if you're trying to get content and deliver it to people so that they can actually use it for the purposes they want to use that content for. And that's another conversation, but it's an important one. I do think that I think all of us know that when we hear something or hear some wild thing or get some crazy email about some totally bizarre thing, we probably now know it's probably not true. And we're then wait for the email that will come sometime afterwards to say, oh, by the way, you know that thing that you just heard, this wild rumor, well, it turns out that's not true, and here are the facts. So there's an active industry out there that's at least trying to debunk the urban legend and trying to get accurate information to the end user. And I think that's where we're going to see born the new journalistic enterprises that will actually work. You know, maybe I always joke, maybe Google will buy the New York Times, and then we'll have some kind of new product that's out there that everyone can say, all right, we will now agree that even if we're having this debate, there's one place we know we can go online where we will get the facts that both sides of the debate will believe, you know, in at the end of the day, that we won't all be entitled to our own facts. You know, we're certainly entitled to our own opinions, whether we're watching CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, and we get plenty of opinions, but we have to have some place where we can have facts, which are not the proprietary custody of one side of the debate or the other. And I think that's where we are falling short right now, but I also think that's where the real opportunities, you know, exist. So if any of you are studying journalism on the side or had some notion that you wanted to go into journalism, I think there will be real careers there that will be, you know, good careers for people, because I think we're going to see that kind of business develop.
A good example of what's going to be lost is we had as a guest a few weeks ago George Condon from Copley, and Copley's bureau no longer exists. Right. And he and a group won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the Congressman Duke Cunningham scandal. And now that same kind of coverage, they can't produce it.
But that's true, and I feel their pain, and his in particular, because he's such a good guy. But part of the problem is they had a bunch of people over age 50 like me running those businesses, and they had no clue what they were doing in an age when people were not reading ink on newsprint anymore. I mean, I would hazard a guess if we took a vote here, how many of you actually go out and pick up a newspaper off your front doorstep every day and read it cover to cover? It's like, you know, anybody? Probably not. You know, like, you have to be our age. And that's because nobody's going to do that anymore, because it's all going to be accessible online. And, you know, how it will seem so quaint to even think that people, you know, one day long ago actually did that. Just like one day long ago we all rode around in buggies with whips. You know, that's the same thing.
Well, yesterday's figures. Well, Romanesco's is a website that has a lot of internal media information, and yesterday they had the latest circulation figures.
Yeah.
And there was one newspaper that actually has gained.
Slightly.
Just a little bit. But it didn't lose, and it was the Wall Street Journal.
And not surprisingly, when you got a global financial meltdown going on, people might actually want to read a little bit more about what is happening on Wall Street.
Yeah, and you have to pay for that one.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say there are models that I think will work when people will be willing to pay for content that's important to them. My kids will pay, and you know, they've stopped illegally downloading music. They use iTunes. They kind of got with the program of what it takes to download something, and they know they're going to pay 99 cents or whatever to get a song that they want or whatever the charge is. They know that they have to charge if they're going to download some cool ringtone that they've heard, and that there's going to be a fee for that. So I think we can acclimate, you know, people to the idea that there's something that they pay for. I mean, we know we pay for the newspaper. We just don't quite understand how. We know we pay something. I think we will get to the point where we will figure out revenue models that will work.
In the Clinton administration, Clinton was very interested in the internet, in addition to Gore being very interested in it. And I can remember several different events where they brought people in from all of the major companies, including the computer makers as well as internet startups. Was there ever a discussion about what would the impact of it, because I know he was very interested in having a free internet. Was there any discussion of what impact that a free internet would have on the gathering and dissemination of information?
No, not at that level. I mean, the policy discussions around the internet were more about what is the role of the federal government in advancing this phenomenon. And it was centered around the 1996 Telecommunications Reform Act.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a conscious decision led by Vice President Gore to say we should not apply the rules of telephony that govern the plain old telephone system to the emergence of this advanced services that are being offered by telecommunications for the internet. It's a very important theoretical debate that goes on, because was the internet or not, was it or was it not born of government involvement? And, you know, yes, in part it was investment of people who worked in the defense sector who were trying to create networks that would network computer systems so they could do certain kinds of things that they wanted to do. But it really was the conscious decision to allow the free market and allow private enterprises to blow out the development of the internet that led to the dot-com explosion in the 1990s, which was a large part of what fueled the economic success that President Clinton enjoyed. Now, some of that washed away in the bursting of the dot-com bubble in 2000, but a lot of it did last, and we've had kind of a resurgence, and clearly the internet digital economy is a very critical part of our economic future now. But we did not, and I plead guilty on this. I did not recognize, just as one example, that the profound role that the internet could have in providing information to the public. And we had some guy off that was creating the White House website, and they were going to put transcripts of my press briefings there. And I checked the box and said, "Sure, that sounds like a great idea. Go ahead and do it. Who's going to want to read that?" You know, I just sort of discounted what the importance was, but. You know, that's become a critical tool for people who are trying to understand the processes of government. And I'd argue that we're not doing a good enough job of bringing technology and creativity into how we make, you know, public information available. And we need to do more of that. And people like you that work on preserving presidential records and compiling them, we ought to think about how we can make that, how we can leverage technology to make that more accessible to students, to researchers, to just the general public.
Much of what you've been talking about deals with the public and its connection with government. When you were press secretary, where did you see the public fitting in to governing?
Well, I saw them, you know, whenever I went and stood at a podium like that one, I thought to myself, they're out there watching.
Uh-huh.
And it's not these crazed reporters in the room that have got their own agendas that I need to think about. I need to think about the American public that is going to be watching this, trying to make sense of this. So in some sense, they are there ever present. And the beauty of the adversarial relationship, as we call it, that exists between the press and the media, the covering the presidency, and then the people around the president who help the president do his work, is that both sides believe that they've got the public on their side. The, mm-hmm. the press believes that they're speaking truth to power. They're there as the representatives, the stand-ins for the public, because they're asking the questions that the public would want to have asked to hold accountable the people with the power. And, of course, on the flip side of the relationship, the political actors believe, well, the public, if they just knew what we were doing, clearly they would think what we're doing is good, because we know from our own polling, or we know we think we're on the right track, we think we have a good argument for what we're about here. So clearly the public will be on our side. So the interesting thing is both sides of this relationship think that they are working in the best interests of the public. And, you know, and yet it's so often they're in conflict with each other, and the agendas are in conflict, and that's where you see the play out of what happens day in and day out in the press briefing room. But I think I became very conscious towards the end of the time I was there that the more we're doing spin, or what was called, you know, being spin doctors, the more that was part of the conversation, the more we were probably making it harder for the public to get what they wanted, which was, someone just tell me what happened. You know, I can figure out whether I'm for or against it on my own. I don't need Rush Limbaugh to tell me. I don't need, you know, someone else to tell me, Keith Olbermann. I just need to know what the facts are, and then I will figure out what my position is. So stop spinning me. Just give me the reliable, accurate information that I can use to make a decision. I think we see a hunger for that now. And I realized in retrospect how much of a political actor I became in doing my job as press secretary. I wish I had probably stayed a little bit more on, let's just stick to what the factual presentation is about, because that'll help people more at the end of the day. Well, every press secretary says that, by the way, in retrospect, and that you get caught up in being an advocate for the president or trying to help the president make a case, because, you know, you're there with your colleagues and you're sort of thrust in the role of being a proponent or a representative of the president's program. And I've taught a lot, and you and I have talked about the role of the press spokesman in other democracies. Western democracies is filled by someone who is a career person who's divorced from the political world. We are sort of unique in having a person called a press secretary who's both a political figure appointed by the president as a political appointee, who also has the role of being an official spokesman for the government.
If you look, though, at the administrations that have followed you, and both Bush and Obama, that in their case they saw the opportunity of the podium for the press secretary as a place to try to persuade people, not so much a place to provide information. I've been doing some interviewing recently, and I found that when I asked people the difference between the Office of Communications, which we have talked about as a persuasion operation, and the press office as an information operation, they have not seen that difference. To them, the difference is that the Office of Communications does long-range planning and that the press office does daily operations, but there's no difference as far as persuasion is concerned. And the problem with that is, like you say, where does the public get information they can trust?
And because particularly if at the same time a lot of the journalistic entities are becoming more and more opinionated, or more and more creatures of whatever part of the political spectrum they're trying to attract for audience share purposes or circulation purposes. And so I really agree with that. I think I was conscious when I did briefings, I would always be aware of, I would be wearing different hats at different moments. Sometimes you're just basically, you're there trying to get basic factual information out so that reporters can write their stories so people can figure out what the hell's going on that day. Then there are other moments when you are trying to kind of rebut your critics, or, you know, rebut what the Republican leadership on Capitol Hill is saying, and you're sort of in conversation dialogue with them. And then there are other times when you're, you know, just basically trying to advance an argument that the rest of the White House and the president is putting forward. And I think unless you signal to your audience where you're coming from, or make it clear what the different roles are that you're playing, it becomes a little hard for the public to follow. Well, what are you being the official spokesman now? Are you being the apologist for the president? Are you being the cheerleader? Are you being the attack dog against the opposition? You know, what's the role that you're playing at this given moment? And we ought to make that a little easier for people by separating out the function. I think the Obama team so far, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I think they have tried to bring out more of their experts who are there just to kind of help illuminate a particular policy initiative. And I think that's a very good use of the press relations apparatus at the White House to bring in people who are even career people in government who are not necessarily part of the political machinery at the White House, but just people who are there because they're knowledgeable. They can tell you firsthand about what's going on. There's a guy in the absence of someone who's politically appointed, who's the head of the Centers for Disease Control. There's a guy who's been on the last couple of days about the swine flu epidemic named David Besser, Dr. David Besser, who's a career guy at CDC, a wonderfully talented doctor who's, you know, a public health expert, and he's been out there carrying the burden of keeping people well briefed. Now, he gets backstopped by Janet Napolitano because the Secretary of Health and Human Services just is, was confirmed about an hour ago, I think. So, you know, now we'll see Catherine Sebelius in that role. But we, you know, we've got a blend of people who are experts along with the people who are the political appointees and accountable. And I think that's the right model. We need a little bit of both.
Yeah, and they came out, Vesser, Napolitano, and then Brennan came out with Gibbs on Sunday to do a briefing. And they do that from time to time. Yeah, hopefully it's a model.
Well, I think that's the best use of the briefing room at the White House to really bring the real actors, the real decision makers, and the experts to bring them in to, so people can see them and understand what they're about. There's sometimes a tendency to say, well, we should only let the president speak on behalf of the administration, and because you know somehow or other subordinates will undercut the message of the president. I just don't think that's true, especially now when there's more desire for authenticity.
You mentioned polling a little while ago, and I don't know how many times in the briefing room that we've heard the press secretary, and we've also heard presidents say, I don't pay any attention to polls. And yet we know that large amounts of money are spent on polling. What's your observation of the way polls are used? I know the public thinks that they're used in a way where the president will decide what issues he'll go for and which ones he'll avoid.
They're used primarily, in my experience, I think that's probably true of most White Houses. What arguments best advance the case that you want to make? I mean, if a president is making critical decisions based on which way the wind is blowing, that's not going to be a very effective president to begin with, in my view, because I think the American people smell through that kind of raw political calculation. But the use of polling to better understand how do certain audiences hear an argument, what's persuasive about what the opposition is saying, you know, how effective is the counterargument to the thing that you're going to be proposing, I think those are all pretty interesting and important uses of that kind of research. And they help you frame the argument that you're going to make and help you become more persuasive. And I think both sides have got, you know, usually in a political debate, both sides have access to exactly that kind of research, and people, as a result, make the best case they can make for the position that they're defending. So I think there's a good, positive use of that kind of data. But you know, if you pick it, say, here's a list of five things, and you know which one polled the highest, and that's what we're going to go out and do today, that you know gets to be a little crass. In the Clinton years, it was somewhat apocryphal and somewhat true. That's for a good dodge, that Clinton's choice of where he was going to take his family on a family vacation was driven in part by how people would react to the, you know, choices he made. Like, was it better to go off to Martha's Vineyard and sip Chablis and eat brie with all the liberal hoity-toities, or was it better to go camping in Wyoming? And I think the first family went camping in Wyoming at, I believe that was the last time they tried that together.
And that was
polling a part of that decision? I'll never tell. I guess I just did.
Can you think of some cases and some arguments that were developed through polling of tough issues where you tried different arguments and then through polling?
Well, one that was for me was I consider one of the better times that I had as press secretary was taking a very complex regulatory issue, which was the premise on which you were going to regulate tobacco as a drug, and the technical premise of the regulation was that a cigarette is a drug delivery device. A cigarette is a drug delivery device designed to administer a dose of nicotine to the human body. And on that basis, the Food and Drug Administration then, in the Clinton years, we promulgated regulations to allow them to regulate the sale of and manufacture of tobacco, later struck down by the Supreme Court. But, you know, that was such a technical rationale for how we were going about doing something pretty important, which was taking on big tobacco. So taking on big tobacco to protect kids and keep kids from dying from nicotine addiction. Those were the thematics that emerged out of some pretty careful research that then allowed you to frame a very complex regulatory decision in a way that would be a little more, you know, user-friendly for the public. Mm-hmm. So that's an example, because if we had started with getting down into the weeds on how we were drafting the regulation, I don't think anybody would have paid much attention. In fact, we did that. We brought in the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the head of the FDA to do the briefing, and it got so technical and bogged down that the reporters were scratching their heads saying, we can't figure out what this is all about because it was too complicated. So we, you know, finding ways to actually frame those things so that they had a little more resonance, that was important. And you see this from time to time, and it's really more about the language that you use. A pretty complicated debate about inheritance taxes in America and what value should we tax at death became, for the Republicans who cleverly were against any form of that type of taxation, the death tax. And by creating a phrase that really sort of owned that debate and framed that debate, I think they were very successful in making a political argument why there shouldn't be taxes on any form of generational inheritance.
Can you think of an issue that that you all just couldn't sell? That there was no way that you could get it across?
Yes, there was early in the Clinton presidency in 1995, we had, and this is in the era before Lou Dobbs, we had to make a case why the United States should be in support of a financial instrument that would help bail out the Mexican peso. And there was just no conceivable way that you could try to win that debate with arguing why it was in the interest of the United States and our economy to go rescue the Mexican economy. And, you know, President Clinton said, well, we don't really have a choice. We have to do it, so we'll just have to try to make the best argument we can. But it was not very politically popular, and it was very hard to sell, and it involved a lot of currency questions and the functioning of international financial markets, which I think is very difficult stuff for people to understand anyhow. I brought people over from the Treasury Department to explain it because I wasn't competent to do it myself. So there are sometimes when you just have to, the functioning of government requires you to do something that's not going to be a winner, and you just have to accept that and do the best you can.
Okay. Let's take some questions. Towson, do you have some questions there?
What was your relationship with the president since you were really the one talking to him? How did you make sure that the words you were saying were the ones he wanted you to use, like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing was to remind myself every morning when I got out of the shower and looked myself in the mirror that nobody on earth cared what my opinion was on any subject. That I was only there because I was a creature of Bill Clinton, and they were very interested in what Bill Clinton had to say. So the first thing was to empty any of your own viewpoints or perspective out so that you could fill yourself up with whatever you thought the president would want to have said on a given subject. And then we had a very elaborate process that began very early in the morning to get the information, to assemble answers, to double check and triple check what we were hearing from various component parts of the White House and the federal government. And then one way or another, I would every day before a briefing either go in to see the president. I had the right to kind of barge in on him in the Oval Office before I was going into my briefing if I hadn't had an opportunity to see him earlier in the day. And I would sort of go through my briefing book. We put together a big fat briefing book every day that had little color-coded dividers according to economics, foreign policy, social policy, politics, whatever the area. And I would sort of flip through that book and say, okay, here's what I'm going to say on such and such a thing. And Clinton would dial me one way or another. Sometimes he would say, oh, no, that's too, you don't say that because I've been talking to Newt Gingrich and he'll get all pissed off if you say that. You know, he'd say, be a little more friendly on that. And then other times he'd say, no, we want to be sharper. You know, we'd want to sharpen up that response. It's too mushy. Sometimes it actually had a great impact because I'd go in and say, okay, this is the answer that I've been given to use on your behalf. And he'd say, well, that's just total BS. And I said, yeah, that's your policy. You know, you want to change it. And so sometimes he would literally pick up the phone and call a secretary or call another officer at the White House and say, we got to do better than this, you know, current situation. What's the deal on this? And sometimes it would provoke an answer. That's, by the way, one of the great reasons why you should do these press conferences like President Obama will do tomorrow night, because they are action-forcing events within the government. So we had a process designed to make sure that the president had the final say on what words, you know, I was going to utter. Now, sometimes I went out on my own. Sometimes I, you know, was a little bit of a lone ranger. And if I got out of line and Clinton didn't like it, he'd let me know. He used to watch the briefings. When I first started doing the White House press briefings, they were not televised live, thank the Lord, but they were on C-SPAN late at night. So Clinton would, it was a night owl, as everyone knows, and he would be sitting there channel surfing sometimes and would see one of my briefings, and he'd pick up the phone and call. If the phone started ringing at 11:30 at night, I'd say, oh, my God, he's watching the briefing again, because he'd watch the replay of my briefing. And he'd kind of call and give me running color commentary. Oh, I like that answer. You shouldn't do this, or you shouldn't say that, or I wish you had said this. I mean, he always had some comment on it. And I finally had to tell him, I said, you know, because I had small kids. I had, you know, a baby in the house at that point. And, you know, he was just waking up the whole family. And moreover, my day started at 4:30 a.m. So I finally had to tell him, you know, can you not call me at 11:30 at night? Which is, you know, he never did after that. And I always kind of thought to myself, you know, I cut myself off from what is one of the most valuable things that anybody can have at the White House, which is direct access to the president. But, I mean, I literally would have, you know, fallen apart and been dead on my feet the following day if I'd had to talk to Bill Clinton all night long. Mm-hmm. So he started calling Rahm Emanuel instead. true story, by the way. Because Rahm used to yell at me. He goes, you know, crying out loud. Now he calls me.
Yeah, Rahm once in an interview I did with him, he was talking about Clinton calling him. He said that he knew that one time that he could talk to Clinton, and for a long period of time about the coming week was on Sundays. And so one Sunday he got a call from Clinton, and it was around the time of the balancing of the budget. And so Rahm said, he said to the president, I know why you're calling. It's about, you know, about this wonderful initiative that you've had and how successful it was, and it was just terrific. And then he said, then there was silence. And then Clinton said to him, do you know a six-letter word in French that, because he was doing the New York Times crossword puzzle.
But that's true. I mean, he would do the crossword puzzle and watch the briefing and Lord knows what else.
So. You all have questions? Over here? We'll take you next.
Thank you. President Clinton is always criticized for his inconsistency and indirection with his domestic and foreign policies. For example, Sino-U.S. relations experienced huge downs and ups during his administration. I'm wondering, did you feel embarrassed when you had to change your tone from time to time when confronted by the media? How did you deal with the situation? Thank you.
Well, it's a good question, and it's a good example. And it was abrupt changes of policy in the foreign affairs area usually came about because of issues that had been raised during the campaign period. One of the truths of American politics is there is largely continuity in the conduct of our foreign policy from administration to administration, with slight changes of emphasis and certainly different tonal qualities. I mean, we're seeing a different tone in American diplomacy now from the previous 8 years. But remember, President Clinton came to office promising a much harder line on human rights and holding much more accountable leaders in Beijing, particularly following the democracy movement in the 1980s. That did not play out very well and led to a downward spiral in U.S.-Sino relations, and there had to be an adjustment and a course correction in order to have a more positive working relationship with the Chinese side. So there was certainly some shifts. Now, was that embarrassing? No, because it largely was opaque to the American people. It was very highly visible to the Chinese side when we made shifts in our diplomacy, even gradual or minute shifts. But there was very little consequence of that on the U.S. side because there was just such not a great deal of interest, not a lot of coverage. We did not do many 180-degree reversals of position. I'd be hard-pressed to think of one. There was one that was embarrassing, I think, to many people in the White House was during the course of the 1996 reelection campaign. President Clinton agreed to sign a thing called the Defense of Marriage Act, which was, I think, was an openly anti-gay piece of legislation, but it was politically at the time popular and very hard for him not to sign it. The justification was if by signing that he prevented a constitutional amendment on gay marriage from getting political velocity. But I don't think many people were me included, very happy with having to stand up and defend that decision. And I don't think President Clinton was very happy having been put in the political position of taking that position. But I think the complexity of managing foreign policy in the face of certain promises made during the campaign was something very hard for President Clinton during the first term. There were a series of issues, Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, in which the rhetoric of the campaign couldn't be matched with the reality of governance when we actually were responsible for running foreign policy. You see some of that same thing happening now with Obama. There's been a marked shift in his tone on things like free trade agreements from the rhetoric of the campaign to the reality of governing. And that is probably normal course of business for most presidencies.
In this past week, he spoke about Armenia.
Yeah.
And during the campaign, he had talked about
its genocide rendered against the Armenians.
Yeah.
And then when you suddenly understand the way in which that will have impact in Turkey at a time when the secular government of Turkey is fragile because of perceived slights to nationhood, then you begin to moderate the tone, and
yeah.
Which is exactly what Obama did.
And he did it.
Just like Clinton did, the same thing Clinton had done during that.
Yeah, and in his case, he said, my policy is the same, my feelings are the same, I'm just not using the word genocide. Because it has such enormous implications in it as far as our relationship with Turkey, and I find that destructive, so I'm not using the word that I used during the campaign. Towson, question?
You spoke about you're talking about religion being a source of our moral values, and I guess think about that a little. Do you think it's still appropriate for Americans to talk about one nation under God, or in God we trust, and if not, what would be a more appropriate phrase in those situations? as far as moral guidance is concerned?
Well, I think one nation under God is, I mean, there are different parts of the myth of we the people that intersect profoundly with the Judeo-Christian myths that are at the basis of those two faith traditions, because the founders themselves were so closely, you know, wrapped up in the spiritual life of the country and the spiritual DNA that is part of what being an American is all about. Remember that religious freedom is why many people came to this country, and separation of church and state was at the heart of it, a protection for people to worship God in the way they wanted to worship, so that there would not be a state establishment of religion. That's what, you know, in modern times we talk about the separation of church and state as if they are two never to be touching each other. But in fact, the history of the Establishment Clause was to protect a very robust religious faith life in the country that emerged as part of our history in the colonial times. So this is a country where 80% of the people profess themselves to be believers. A good two-thirds of the country believe that they are religious people themselves. Something like 60% of the country believes in the literal interpretation of the Bible. It's a profoundly religious country. And I think understanding how faith can shape decisions in the public realm and embracing that and not being and talking about it in a more conscious way, I think, is a very healthy thing. Now, that goes with the stipulation that you respect those from different faith traditions and respect those who do not profess a religious faith. But I do think that we are a country with that tradition, and it would be hard for us to walk away from that tradition, including in the way in which we stamp slogans on our coinage, mm-hmm. among other things.
Yeah. Over here.
Thank you. I was just wondering, earlier in the interview, it was brought up presidential interviews. I'm wondering, why do you believe that some presidents have chosen to do more than others, more interviews, at least in the first 100 days? And then Professor Kumar mentioned statistics of Clinton did, you know, 8 or so, and Obama's done 26. And I'm wondering if you at all regret not pushed Clinton to do more, but that he had done more interviews. Do you regret that now?
Well, I have at least some. I get off the hook a little bit because I was at the State Department during Bill Clinton's first 100 days. I wasn't actively at the White House, but I think Clinton was generally seen as a fairly accessible president during those first 100 days. In fact, almost too accessible in the minds of White House staffers who eventually had to curtail access, because it's not, as Dr. Kumar can tell you, it's not just the formal interview or the formal press conference. It's also the less formal encounters day in and day out in which the press has an opportunity to question the president. And in Clinton's case, he'd go out for a jog in the morning and sometimes stop and get a McDonald's. And I think at one point he was getting his coffee at McDonald's and having a walking press conference with the White House press pool traveling around with him. And there was a real effort to kind of limit that kind of access. It was not seen as presidential to have the president walking around in his jogging suit talking about, you know, important matters of state. So access by the media to the president is something that really is heavily litigated always between the press corps that's at the White House and the White House staff and the president. And I think Clinton got to a point where he was first 4 years, he was comfortable in his interactions. We did quite a number of interviews. I think the number, though, reflected more what we've talked about earlier in the evening. It was, there are such an explosion of diversified publications that reach niche audiences that if you want to try to hit those targeted audiences, you do more of those kinds of interviews rather than the broad-based interviews with the network television or the large national newspapers. So I think it just is, it's part of the shift, and part of the numbers reflect the changes in the media itself over time.
And I think, too, if I look at three types of interchanges, presidential press conferences, and that breaks down to joint and solo, short question and answer sessions, which is where a pool of reporters that Mike's talking about, like in the Cabinet Room, Oval Office, Roosevelt Room, and then interviews. And Obama has stressed interviews, and what he has not done were short question and answer sessions. In the contrast is enormous, because at this point Obama's done, I think he did one yesterday, so it's up to 17. He's done 17 of these short Q&As, and Clinton had done 82.
Yeah.
And Bush had done 59.
Right. That is the big change in Obama, is the impromptu Q&A, which is more likely to be diverted off to some other subject that the press corps is interested in. They have really throttled back on that in favor of these more formal engagements when it's a sit-down interview and the subject matter is more or less known to the White House staff in advance. And I think that's a real change. I mean, they are much more disciplined and precise about managing their encounters with the media, right down to the president standing there and being very, very clear that he is calling on a list of reporters that's been handed to him by his staff, and he's not going to pick favorites in the room. He's going to go through a very carefully constructed list. And, you know, the subliminal message to the reporters, I think, is if you want to get on that list, you better go cozy up to Robert Gibbs and other people, and otherwise you're not going to make the cut. That's a change in the power relationship between the media and the press. I never would have dreamt that I could get away with something like that when I was at the White House. But I think things have changed so much because the power equation is so much different. The press doesn't have kind of the inherent power that it used to have, you know, even a decade ago.
If you had told Clinton who to call on, he would have.
He probably wouldn't have followed.
He wouldn't have listened anyway, because he would have. He knew the press corps.
And knew the rhythm of what he wanted to do too. I mean, I'd stand in the corner and say last question, and then he'd let the press conference go on for another 30 minutes sometimes.
Yeah, in the State Department.
Yeah, he was just
several times he was trying to stop it.
He enjoyed it. It was performance art for him. I think when you watch Obama do these press conferences, you get no sense that he enjoys the encounter. He's very businesslike and very, you know, he knows exactly what he's trying to get out of the session and what he's going to do and what message he's there to deliver, and he's very disciplined about it.
I think that an example of why they stay away from the short Q&As was last week, I think it was last Tuesday, when the president was asked about torture and the torture memos and what kind of action should be taken, who was going to be held responsible. And he kept that issue going in a way he had not intended.
Right. Right.
And so the press secretary, on two occasions since then, has sent a message that they're not going to do that again, that was a mistake. When a reporter was saying the other day, was asking about something that Gibbs said, we don't deal in hypotheticals. And so the reporter said, well, the other day the president was talking about what should be done on torture. He's dealing in hypotheticals. And so Gibbs said, let me reiterate, there is going to be no discussion of hypotheticals from anyone in this administration in the future. So I thought the next 100 days are probably going to be fewer than 60 short question and answer sessions. And on news conferences, they had pretty much the same, except that Obama's had three nighttime news conferences and Clinton had not had any. But in the joint news conferences, one of the things that I thought was interesting in the differences is that in his first 100 days, Clinton had joint press conferences with Canada with the Prime Minister of Canada. He had England. He had Mitterrand. He had Rabin, Yeltsin, and I think they were eight of them. And Miyazawa from Japan. And all of them were in the United States. All of them took place in the United States. And it reflected his interest in bringing people here. In Obama's case, all of his joint newsers have been, with foreign leaders, have been out at particular meetings.
But that's also a reflection of some of the tonal quality in U.S. diplomacy, moving away from, the idea that we are exceptional and they would all beat a path to our door has given way to a need right now for more reaching out and more diplomacy to embrace those countries a little more on an equal footing.
Yeah. Which Towson?
The last 8 years.
As press secretary, how do you handle a situation like, say, the Lewinsky case where the president really has no moral justification of his actions? And how, in your opinion, was Clinton almost able to overcome it and yet remain so popular amongst Democrats even over the past few years?
Well, I think in that instance, everything about the normal way we did business at the White House got turned upside down. I spent most of my time as press secretary working hard to get all the information so that I would be on top of anything that developed at the White House and know what the answers to the follow-up questions would be. We worked very hard at accumulating that substance. When it came to Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, it was exactly the opposite, which is there was one statement that had been developed by the president in consultation with lawyers. None of us had talked to President Clinton about the matter because if we had, we would have been subject to subpoena and would have had to hire lawyers ourselves. So we never had private conversations about, what's the deal with you and this intern. So we pretty much stuck to a script that didn't change for 8 months. And in that 8 months, I think the real problem, how did President Clinton survive that? Well, the public got very sick and tired of hearing the same questions asked all the time with the same answer being given all the time. And that's why they finally said, quite literally, move on. Get off this subject, move on to something else. And then secondly, people were very satisfied with Clinton's performance in office. His job favorability ranked high. The performance of the economy was strong, so people felt secure about their economic future. And they just came to believe that there were more important things than what Clinton did or did not do with this intern. I think you're right, your premise of your question. There was a loss of moral authority because of what President Clinton eventually had to confess that he had done that probably made it hard to achieve everything that he wanted to achieve in his presidency. And that was a big price to pay for, his behavior. But he paid the price. He made the apology appropriately to the country for having misled the country, even though I think in his heart of hearts believed that he had not really misled the country. But that's all, how do you define sexual relations? Anybody like to go there right now? Well, the answer, for those of you who are young and don't remember, it all has to do with oral sex and how you count oral sex at the end of the day, which was a fun thing to have to stand up and talk about day after day for 8 months when you know your wife is watching the briefing. So, anyhow. But I think that's the answer to the question. The question is just it went on so long that people just got so sick of it that they didn't want to hear about it anymore, and they tended to discount the gravity of the matter at the end of the day.
And people are pretty forgiving. When Reagan was questioned about his role in Iran-Contra, and he went on television and made an apology, he said, I really didn't think that we had anything to do with this, and then people bring me these memos showing that actually we did, but gee, I just didn't remember that way, but I guess that's the way it was. So you can apologize, but try to at the same time just keep on thinking what you were thinking. Yeah, in the back. Yeah, we'll take one him, and then we'll take one more Towson.
First, I want to say thank you. It's been very interesting. As a person who studies theology, what do you think Obama should do? What kind of church should he choose? Thanks.
This is much debated now because there was a story in the Washington Post today about where will they eventually choose to go worship and what church will they become a member of. And I think, you know, as much as everything that the president does, from picking a puppy to what schools his children go to all the kind of little quality of life things that come up at the White House, at the end it's like any other family trying to make a decision about where to go to church when they move to a new community. You want to pick a place where you feel like you are comfortable and you feel like the expression of faith and the proclamation of the gospel that you hear fits with, you know, what you personally believe. And I think in his case, it's going to be a place where two young children can grow up and be in a youth program and be nurtured in their own faith. And so I think that a large part of it will be where he feels like his kids will have a good experience too. He's been, you know, he knows it's not just a personal decision because of the experience he had with the church that he worshipped at in Chicago and the more incendiary comments of the minister there, which was, you know, probably unfair to Jeremiah Wright. I don't think that really reflected entirely his entire body of work as a preacher. But I think they understand they will have to be conscious of what kind of clergy leadership a church has, what kind of community is it. They will have an impact on that church. My friends at Foundry Methodist Church, that's where Bill Clinton worshipped when he was at the White House, and having the president show up for worship on Sunday mornings is, you know, taxes the capacity of any church. So they'll probably have to pick a place that can accommodate the president and all the hoopla that goes with that on a Sunday. But I think it's a matter, as much as I've talked about this today, I still think it's for many people, their expression of religious faith is a very private matter. For Obama, he's comfortable talking more publicly about his own faith. And I think how he worships on a given Sunday will become of real interest to the American people. Jimmy Carter, when he was president, actually taught Sunday school and was very active in the Baptist congregation that he worshiped at here in town. And, you know, maybe that's what Obama will do. It's you know, probably something that will be very personal, and it should be authentic. I mean, I guess my only real answer to your question is that it ought to be something that's really true to what he and his wife and his family really want in terms of their own spiritual development.
Towson, one last question.
Last question, as we used to say at the White House.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. As a press secretary, the president's policies come before your morals. What suggestions do you have for this press secretary and how he should pursue his agenda and what he believes?
Well, I hinted at this earlier. I think you pretty much check your own beliefs and issues at the door. I mean, I don't think you can be an effective press secretary if you disagree with everything the president is doing. I think you have to remind yourself consciously every day that it's not about the staff, it's not about what you believe, it's not about your preferences. You're really there to help the president convey what the president's thinking and decision-making is about. And I think Robert Gibbs, the current press secretary, has a very healthy view of that. He is both simultaneously a very valued advisor to Obama. Obama trusts him and likes him and really relies upon him for counsel. But I think he's also a very, humble person. He's not trying to assert his own viewpoint over that of of the president himself. So I think he's probably struck a pretty good balance. But I think humility is one of the two things that when people say, what are the two most important things about the job or the most important ingredients for success, I always say humility and humor. You know, you have to kind of not take yourself too seriously and, appreciating that some of the craziness that goes on in the job is a good thing. and then just understanding it's not about you and you shouldn't take things personally because it really is about the presidency. That's probably a good place to end. Yeah. Thank you, everyone. Those are very good questions.
Thank you.